You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Yop. Scuttlewhip, mister, scuttlewhip. One of the nicest sights I think I ever saw with horses would be the Punchestown races. And we'd be coming home from the laundry, with the laundry horse coming in, and all the horse buggies and carriages and everything, horses pulling everything, all sorts of carriages and coaches and wagons and drays with tens and twenties people on it, and a race down the Longmire Road coming back from Punchestown.
Eamon McComish with his earliest memories of horses in Dublin. The carrying firm of W. Richardson Limited was established in the year 1830, and a descendant of that family, Frank Richardson, took over control of the firm in the year 1938. What kind or kinds of horses were used?
The Irish draft horse was the principal one, and Clydesdale horses. There were, of course, mixed breeds, one to the other. Shire horses were also used, but for general carrying work were not as satisfactory as Clydesdales and Shires and Irish draft. The principal one was the Irish draft.
Why was the Shire not so popular? Why wasn't he so suitable?
Well, they were magnificent-looking horses, very big horses, with big hairy feet. They were a bit slower, not as agile as the Clydesdale or Irish draft. And for general carrying, as I say, not as satisfactory. Now, Guinness has used mostly Shire horses, but they looked on their horses as advertisements, and the more magnificent looking the horse was, the better.
The Hunter was the most common horse, particularly for drawn bred vans and Landry vans and all that.
But those big horses, the Clydesdales and the Shires, had big hairy feet which caused problems. According to George Kearns, whose family has been connected with horse dealing for quite some time, hairy needs looking after.
Because hair, you know, gathers dirt. And dirt causes cancer, or canker, I should say, sorry. Well, in some jobs, you see, you hadn't got the best of stablemen, or the men that looked after them. And hair needs looking after. Every day. Even at night time, a wet night. See that day today now when the slush and snow is out there, outside the window? You bring a horse in at night there. His legs are all wet. You just couldn't leave him that way. He had to be dried out. And with a bloody towel and into his heels. And that was one reason why a lot of people didn't like hair-legged horses. Though hair-legged horse, they reckoned, well, he had a little more strength. You know, But that was one thing about hair. Hair, unless you look after it, it's like your own hair. It's like children's hair. Nits get into them and everything.
And Frank Richardson, with his experience as a licensed general carrying agent, found that these horses weren't quite practical for his requirements.
They were magnificent-looking horses, very big horses, with big hairy feet. They were a bit slower, not as agile as the Clydesdale or Irish draft. And for general carrying, as I say, not as satisfactory.
Of course, I think the first horses drawn anything was the horses drawn the canal barges up along the banks of the Grand Canal. And in fact, we used to lead the horses. And the funny thing about this was you'd lead them way up to nearly the fifth or sixth lock. And then when you found you had to walk back on your own without the horse, like walking along with the horse didn't seem to be much of a walk, but when you had to come back on your own. But horse transport was a way of life for an economical way of life for communities and for business people. Most of companies, the B&I, they'd all their own set of horses. Guinness's, hundreds of horse drays for bringing the barrels of porter around. The LMS, all the railway, the post office with the big creel cars, all the bakeries, every bakery horse car, very few motor cars, all the laundries were all horse cars. Of course, all the bellmen selling coal around the city was all horse cars. And then it came up to, see, transport at that time, motor cars at that time were expensive. And, of course, you could run a horse for a couple of bob a week because oats was cheap and hay was cheap and straw was cheap, things like that. They had all around Dublin these lovely stone water fountains where the horse could pull up and get his drink. So the horse was on Cork Hill. There was a very big sign as you came up Cork Hill: give way to horse traffic. So all horse traffic going up Cork Hill had to get right away. Of course, all funerals were all, the hearse was all drawn by horses, and beautiful black horses. And if it was a married person who died, the horses wore black plumes. And if it was a single person, they wore white plumes. So this brought it up to about 1938. And then, for some unknown reason, I suppose it was mass production, motor cars began to become cheap. And as we came into, say, 39, just at the war, some companies were gradually making the changeover from horses to motor cars. And companies that had 100 horses now had, say, 80 horses and 10 motor cars. So the changeover was just about coming, and a lot of the horses were getting sold off and put out in grass and stuff like that. And then came the war. And of course, when the war came, the petrol scarce, immediately it was back to the horse again. And then, of course, the war years was the horses on. I think everywhere was horse car. All around the country, people coming in for mass was all horse car.
You wanted a horse that wasn't too heavy, rangy type of horse, biggish horse, and a good mover. You bought them about 5, 6, 7 years old. They'd be trained at that time. You'd buy them for, you'd get them for a trial, and they had to be passed by a vet, and then they entered work, you see. They would work until the age of about 12, 13, 14. It all depended on the individual horse, and a lot of it depended on the individual drivers. And after that, they would be placed whenever possible with farmers and given a good home.
Where did you buy the horses?
From various horse dealers, Cooper's was the principal one we dealt in my time.
Well, of course, Cooper was a very reputable and famous horseman. There's no doubt about that. Actually, I think it was a tragedy to see them going out of Queen Street down there. I can nearly still smell the old horses. That was the great thing when you come over Queen Street Bridge. The first thing you could smell was Cooper's, the manure, and the horse has a certain odour of its own, which is you know, it's a nice kind of, it's a very hard thing to describe, but it's a nice smell, and it's a good feeling. No, there was lots of travelling people, the old tinkers, they sold plenty of horses, and you had different people down the country selling horses.
My father used to go to fairs, and my grandfather, and buy them at fairs, but I never did that.
The fairs held different types of horses. They were known for different types of horses. Longford the Mullingar horses 15-2, 15-3, which was used as milk service, as we were known as, you know, the man that served milk around Dublin. As I said earlier, he got the Ballybay for a good hairy legged one. And incidentally, further on Mullingar and Longford, you get the same type of horse, 15-2, 15-3, but you have a lot more hair to him. Same height and everything, same. Purer horses, though, coming off purer land. That was the difference, too. Down in Enniscorthy, New Ross, Wexford country, you buy a bloody good blood horse, little or no hair to his legs. And he could plough or mow. He'd do anything. He'd pull a bloody cart, too.
He was adaptable.
Utility. I think that would be the word more than anything else. Castle Blakeney in the County Galway, I think it was... You'd buy a hairy leg fella there, 16 hands and that. Buy a good horse in Cork. Do for anything, riding horse or anything. See, these fairs held everything. It wasn't just for the one dealer, for the one thing in mind or the one. And these dealers would buy anything. They'd buy anything. They'd see something there. They'd buy a donkey home to bring home with a horse to keep other young horses quiet.
And then, of course, you had the wonderful thing of the horse called Workman, who was an old horse that was bought for something like £5 and used to pull a milk float around Kildare. And this day, they were out. He was out in the field, and they went out to catch him. And he got a bit of a sprite in. He says, "You're not catching me this morning." So he started a shenanigan around the field, and the boys chased him and said, "Right, get him up against this wall, and we have him." So when he got up to the wall, the bell workman went right over it. And when they measured it, it was something like 6 inches higher than Beecher's Brook. So Workman was entered for the Grand National, and Workman won the Grand National. I think there was some gentleman in Navan owned him at that time. But that was, I think, 1938, Workman won the Grand National. That was great. And then when Cahoo won the Grand National, like the McDowell's horse and Early Mist and all those coming back along the Keane, the parade up O'Connell Street, you know, it was fantastic. I remember Gene Autry, when Gene Autry brought his horse Champion over to the Theatre Royal, and all the people in O'Connell Street with scissors trying to cut a few hairs off Gene Autry's tail as a souvenir.
Good fellas all, that's straight and tall, take counsel and be wise. Attention pay to what I say, my lecture don't despise. Let patience guide you on every side of traitors, now beware. There's none but men would glory win can ride my old grey mare. In Erin's Isle, in ancient times, she was rode by Brian Boru. Phelim O'Neill with sword of steel on Roe and Sarsfield too. Brave Michael Dwyer not long ago ranged Wicklow and Kildare. Taunt Andy Shears and other peers rode on my old grey mare. Brave Bonaparte on her did start, he rode too fast, 'tis true. She lost a shoe at Moscow Fair and fell lame at Waterloo. When she comes o'er to Weirin shore, she'll have good farrier's care. At the very next chase, she'll win the race, my sporting old grey mare. In terms of employment alone, the horse was extremely valuable. At peak periods, Richardson's yard stabled 70 horses.
We were completely self-contained. There was a place called Springfield off the Harberton Road near Rialto. We had a very big premises there. We had two carpenters permanently employed making and repairing lorries. We had two blacksmiths, again, shoeing horses and putting the tyres on lorry wheels. We made our own wheels too. We had two carpenters, two harness makers, and they made and repaired harnesses necessary. Then there were three yard men. There was a head yard man and two under yard men. Their job was to cut, we had an electric motor for cutting hay and bruising oats. They had to, once the men went off in the day, it was their job to clean out the stables, keep the place in proper order, have the feed ready in it for when the men came back in the evening time.
As well as the tradesmen that you mentioned there, you had the stablemen, you had the stable boys, and then you also had, as well as the stable boys, you had what was known as the horse boy. Now, like you take, at the moment, you take... Take Sheriff Street at the moment, which is a very run-down area where employment is concerned and where there's millions of ships coming in with containers that only need three or four men. There's not a hope of a young fella in Sheriff Street getting a job. Well, 30 years ago, you'd be scoured in Sheriff Street looking for young fellas because you would have bought a new horse, and the new horse maybe would come up in the country and be a bit shy to the city traffic. Well, you couldn't put him out in the city of Dublin with all the traffic. You had to have a horse boy. So a horse boy got a couple of quid for just holding the horse while your man was making the deliveries all day. And there was all these auxiliary services. There was the oats delivery. There was the hay. There was the straw. And then, of course, there was the manure. The manure itself used to sell a cartload of manure for 5 shillings. Then it went up to 10 shillings. Then it was a pound. But I remember it at one time, big notice going up. Manure free. Please take it away today. And a bloody big mountain of it. You know, couldn't get rid of it. And people at that time didn't realise that manure grew your vegetables or your flowers and things like that. But there was always employment. There was always a shilling to be made in some small way where the horse was concerned. The horse buy is one aspect. The horse and cars then used to, if they got to a stage where there'd be a long carry, maybe the horse wouldn't be able to pull the car up a whole hill, some place like that. Well, that would mean extra breasters to go out and help to carry the coal up the hill. So it was extra money.
When you say extra breasters, what do you mean by breasters?
A breaster, the difference between a breaster and a carter are basically the same thing. They both carry the bag of coal into your house. But the breaster works on a motor lorry. The carter works with a horse.
From the point of view of the country's economy, I should have imagined it was a very important factor. For instance, a lot of our lorries were built of Irish oak. Whether you can still get that or not, I just don't know. The hay and oats were all produced here and bought here. We used to use about 1,500 to 2,000 barrels of oats a year. And I've forgotten how many tons of hay, but we, you know, the lot.
Both man and horse worked hard. 6 days a week, for man and for horse. 2 rounds a day, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And the horse carried, on average, a load of 2 tons each round. It made for a tough life, long hours and long days. And it's not surprising, I suppose, to find out that strong relationships were hammered out between man and animal.
And the carters in Donnelly Coal Yards were so familiar with the horses that I've known many of them to be in first turn the next morning for the work. You see, they were paid on piecework. So the earlier they were in the morning to get the pick of the work, it paid off. They'd come in late at night, 10 o'clock, go in, unyoke the horse, put away the harness, put the horse down on the bed, and then at the last minute decide, sure, why should I go back to Sean McDermott's seat at last night? I'll stay here for the night. And bed down in the stable with the horse and be up then at 6 o'clock the next morning, horse yoked up, and be forced out the gate to get the first pick to work.
Relationships between man and animal must have been quite strong.
Very strong. 90% of the coal men, or in fact you would see a lot of this happening, they would go out the door in the morning. Now, of course, they all had to go up the quay to Butt Bridge, so it was a straight run up. But they would wrap the reins around their legs and take out their paper and probably study farm or pick what horse they were going to back, or maybe have a flask of tea or a sandwich or a smoke or even a late sleep, nod away, and the old horse would just plodder away right up to O'Connell Bridge, and then they go another bit further. And then, of course, the house-to-house delivery where the horse just yup-yup and he moved on, hike-hike, and he stopped. Yeah, there was a great relationship between the two. Then, of course, you had a great number of vets working because the horses got sick just the same as the human beings. And then, of course, in the winter time when the snow and the frost and the ice, of course, the horse had to have special frost nails and there had to be special sacking and... I think the nicest thing on that line was we were coming down by Hazel Hatch one night with the Landry van, and it had started to freeze about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and as we came to Hazel Hatch Bridge, the ice was now, from there to Peamount, it was just like glass. There was about 5 or 6 cottages, small cottages, and it was bitter cold Wednesday evening. And next, one man stuck his head out of the cottage and he says, oh, you'll never get over that bridge, you'll never take that bridge. So next, another man came to the scene. He says, if you had a few shovelfuls of clay, you could get a few shovelfuls of cinders, any cinders there in the fire. So they went around. Before I knew where it was, there was maybe 6 or 8 men, and they'd all shovels. Now, they were total strangers to us, and they shoveled clay and dirt all the way from Hazel Hatch Bridge to Peamount Gate to get us up to Peamount. You know, like, that type of... Once it was the horse. Do you know what I mean? Whereas you could be broke down in your motor car and you could stay there. There was those who talked to the horse, and there was those who growled with the horse, you know, gave out to the horse and sort of not hit him now, but took it out voice wise on the horse, you know, blamed the horse. I've known men to come out of the coal yard with a nice load and say to the horse, that was a nice load I got, Maggie. We got a nice load, Maggie. And I've known fellas to come out and say to the horse, well, what are you standing there looking for, you bloody idiot, now? Look at the bloody load we're out there getting. Yeah, you're not carrying it, you're only pulling it, you know. And there was this great family connection. The horse was part of him. He was part of the man. And very, very few. I've never known any of them to be cruel to the horse.
As after all, a well-looked-after animal will last a lot better, taking a practical view of it, will last a lot better and be much happier than one that's ill-treated in any way. And incidentally, if we ever got reports, as we occasionally did, of a man ill-treating his horse, and it was proved, well, the man would be sacked at once. But these reports had to be taken with reservation. I remember on one occasion an old lady coming in to see me and saying that a certain man had been beating his horse with an iron bar. I couldn't believe this. We checked on the horse, found out who it was, and there wasn't a mark on the horse at all. he obviously hadn't been doing that. He may have given it an odd flick with a switch or something, which was quite normal in those days, but no mark on the horse. But if ever we found a horse with marks on him from beating, the man was discharged at once.
Yeah, a relationship between a man passing from man to animal, from driver to his cart horse, I can understand. But is it possible that that relationship was reciprocated in a reverse way, from horse to driver?
Oh, very much so. Several horses wouldn't move unless they're a particular man. Like, you could come up and say, yup, yup, but the horse, you know, cock his ears, sort of, he would wait until he knew, and he knew. I think the best one of the horse playing his part, the bellmen, who had a very small cut between the profit and loss. Like, they didn't buy coal all that cheap, so they hadn't a great marginal profit on the ton of coal. So they used to try and get an extra bit of weight, and this was all part of the business. But one of the ways of getting a bit of weight was when they were weighing the car in, take the tear weight of the car. So the horse would come in, the car would be on the scales, and then just as you were about to set the beam, it was a beam type scale, you had to push the beam up and down to find exactly where this car weighed. But while you were manipulating that, the bellman would go something like that, and the horse would actually look around its head towards the window where I was weighing, possibly to see was I watching it. And then, if I was or I wasn't watching it, the horse's two back feet would bang up onto the scales, which would make about 300 weight or 200 weight more in the weight going out the gate. Now, that was famous, that one. And there was lots of the horses that, you know, like, if these horses had been in circus, they'd have made a gold mine. Oh, yeah, very much so.
Yes, I'm sure they would. I came across a copy of an agreement made between the Richardson firm and Guinness's, dated 1898. One of the paragraphs in it reads, "Such of the classes of vehicle to be supplied by the contractor shall be capable of carrying the following amount of goods, viz. Each lorry shall be capable of carrying a load of 3 tons, and shall be horsed accordingly, each float 2 tons, and each dray 24 hundredweight. The term town, as applied to deliveries in this agreement, and as applicable to the prices set out in the schedule hereto, shall include the municipal area of the city of Dublin, and the term inner circle vicinity shall include a radius of 6 miles from St. James's Gate Brewery, and the term outer circle vicinity shall include a radius of 14 miles from St. James's Gate Brewery. And the schedule, well, it's interesting. Town deliveries. Rate per ton, 2 shillings and 6 pence. Horse, man and lorry per day, 12 shillings. Horse, man and float per day, 10 shillings. Horse, man and dray per day, 8 shillings, and so on down to horse, man and dray per hour, 1 shilling. Inner circle vicinity deliveries went rate per ton 8 shillings. Horse, man and lorry per day 14 shillings. Horse, man and float per day 10 shillings. Horse, man and dray per day 8 shillings and on so on down to the end where it says horse, man and dray per day 1 shilling. Well, it's hard to imagine these days that anybody would make a fortune on those particular prices, but I suppose we have to remember that this agreement was drawn up in 1898. I wondered when I was speaking to Eamon McComosh if in fact the horse and the lorry or the dray and the driver were very much a part of the scene of Dublin, of the overall picture of the city.
A famous thing when I was growing up was scut the whip. And that, of course, was that when you were a kid, you never walked anywhere, very, very rarely walked anywhere, although at the same time, you never spent a penny on the tram. If you did get on the tram, you tried to get off without paying the penny. The funny thing there was there was 2 steps in the tram. At each end of the tram, there was steps, and we'd go on top, and when he'd come up 1 steps, we'd go down the other stairs. And then when he go up the other stairs, we'd be going up and down all to try to get in without paying the penny. But you always scuttered. Now, all funerals were scut, sitting on the back of the cab. And all horse and cars, if you wanted to go, we'd say, down to Guinness's Jetty, which was a favourite place where all the horses lined up along Guinness's Jetty, waiting for the delivery. The barges would be taking the barrels down to the custom house, bringing them across the ships in England. But all the quay would be a line of horse traffic. Well, all you had to do was go down to Kilmainham Cross. Now, within a matter of minutes, there'd be 6 or 7 horse cars coming down, maybe Lamb's Jam Factory or B&I horses going back after being out delivered in Toronto's Chocolate Factory or something like that. Get on the back, sit on the back, jump on the back, because you could run as quick as them. Jump up on the back and then someone would shout out, "Scud the whip, mister, scud the whip." And he'd flick the whip back, long whip back, to get your hands, you see, to hit. Well, I think that there was less accidents in those days. People got there. Do you know what I mean? Maybe they didn't get there as quick, but they got there. And there were less accidents. Very rarely you read or heard of someone being killed by a horse and car. It was somebody knocked down, yes, by a horse and car. And then there was the lovely excitement of the time. I won't say every day in the week, but every day in the month, there'd be a runaway. A horse would get frightened on board, and the local hero would be out charging, shooting on. And some fella who you thought wouldn't say boo to anyone was the local fella who threw himself in front of the horse and stopped the horse. And everyone in Dublin wanted to do this. This was real Gene Autry stuff off Tom Mix and John Wayne, the pictures. And I think that was the lovely thing, the runaways. And Kilmainham Cross was a great place for runaways because the old tram, the trams made a terrible lot of noise. And I think it was in England, some woman was talking something, there was some discussion something about sex. And some woman said, "Well, as long as they don't do it in the street and frighten the horses." And I think this was the thing. The one thing that scared the horses was the trams, you see, used to, when the aerial going up to the wires, the connection, when that would go along, it'd give it a swizz. But then also it'd throw off green and blue and red lights. And one of these sparks would explode, you know, with a bang. And, of course, a horse would be standing there, his ears would cock up, and next he'd get the bit in his teeth, and he'd be away. And then everyone would be out, "Runaway horse, clear the road, runaway horse." And then the local hero. But it was always one of my dreams, as a child, the Walter Mitty dream, that I would stop a runaway horse in College Green or something, but I never did.
Thank you.
And, of course, at this stage, it's highly unlikely that Éamon Mac Hamáis is going to achieve his ambition of saving or stopping a runaway horse and saving the beautiful young lady, be she princess or otherwise, on that particular cart. Mind you, it's possible that it may happen because there is a revival of interest in the draft horse and there is a revival of interest in the heavy horse. The current edition of the Farmers Weekly has an article and this paragraph is from it. The revival of the heavy horse has been a triumph for perseverance, popular appeal and public relations. From near extinction a few years ago, the heavies have become a crowd-pulling attraction that can draw applause to equal that for the show jumpers at Wembley's Horse of the Year show, or 10,000 spectators to a horse ploughing match such as the Southern Counties Heavy Horse Association's All England Championships at Windsor. Here at home, of course, Bord na Gcapall and the Irish Draft Horse Association are doing great work as well, so hopefully we may see more of the dray horses on the streets of Dublin. That is, of course, if that particular horse can make his way through the traffic, the density of traffic that exists in Dublin and indeed in other cities. It may happen. It may become a practical and a viable proposition. One thing I wonder about, though, and that is why did the horse disappear, did the dray horse disappear from the streets of Dublin so suddenly? Was it just traffic or were there other reasons?
Now, by about 1953, I think, or 54, early in the mid-50s, you could buy a hunter for something, say, 30 quid, you could get a hunter, because I worked at that time in Donnelly Coal Merchants, and the big horse dealer was Cooper at Queen Street, and we used to buy the horses from Cooper, and you could get one for around 30 quid. Then some genius came along with an idea that you could export horses for horse meat and that you could get something like 5 or 6 pounds a hundredweight. Now, if a horse weighed 10 or 11 hundredweight, that was 66 quid for a horse that you could only buy for 30 quid. So now horses became a money proposition. And I worked on the docks, and every day down the docks by the cobblestones, you'd hear the pitter-patter, the clip-clop, hundreds upon hundreds of horses down to the B&I boat going over to England to be slaughtered, used for horse meat and whatever else was used then. In fact, it got so bad that I think this was, it may have been the National Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, or it may have been a branch committee off that. But I remember a big parade through the city of Dublin. Stop exporting horses for slaughter. And the irony of this is the company I was with at the time loaned 25 horses to march in the parade, and the same 25 horses were on the boat the following week all afternoon to be slaughtered. So they made a last protest. But then by 1955, nearly most places had made the changeover gradually. And then horses were kept in some companies because there were places where only a horse could go. You know, there were sort of little alleyways in Dublin where you couldn't get a motor car up, so the horse was handy to get up to these places. And they kept on a handful of horses, 3 or 4 horses. I joined Donnelly Coal Merchants in the 40s, and at that time they had something like, I think it was 126 horses, 2 steam motor cars. Now, by 1955, the same company had something like 100 motor cars and 2 horses. So like within the period of time, they swung over. So
In actual fact, the disappearance of the horse, while in a sense it might appear to be gradual, actually happened quite suddenly.
The disappearance of the horse was ruthless because it was speculating, it was money-making. And what actually, it was wiped out in, I'd say maybe 6 months or a year at the most. the whole of 1953 or 54, whatever year it was. But the minute the money, like the minute the horse became more valuable dead than alive, this is what killed it. And I remember, now I worked on the Spencer Dock Bridge, and they had to pass under over that bridge, well, under and over, because it was a two-way bridge. But they had to come across that bridge. And I would say that in one afternoon, anything up to 600 to 800 horses, they come galloping down along that, like as if it was out in the Wild West in Texas or somewhere, and they'd be all galloping down, in all 16 across the road, all galloping down, all tied to one another, being brought down to the boat to be brought away for slaughter.
Mr. Richardson, of course, people can become very emotional about horses, indeed about all animals, but particularly, I think, about the horse. There can be a great deal of, I think, emotional nonsense talked about the animal. But surely that couldn't have entered too much into the carrying business.
Well, it did, particularly in latter years. There was a great deal of agitation about cruelty to horses, horses being shipped to Belgium and France for food and so on. And we were approached on many occasions. Indeed, if I remember rightly, we were attacked in the newspapers on occasions any time we got rid of a horse. Well, from a business and practical point of view, you have to get rid of a horse. We did our level best to make sure that they went to farms and so on. And very often, when they did go to farms, we heard afterwards they mysteriously disappeared from the farm. You know, from a practical point of view, from a business point of view, you just couldn't keep track. You had to, once they weren't able to do their full day's work, you had to get rid of them.
You got a horse in at 5 years old, Trend. What was his working life with you?
Well, it depended on the horse, first of all, and largely depended on the driver. If you had a driver that drove his horse too hard, well, he didn't last so well. I may say that the horses were well looked after. We had a contract with Mr. Lambert. Lambert's the vet, so you ought to know them well. And any time that anything was wrong with the horse, he was sent for at once. I may say that this was in the form of a contract. We paid him whether he came or not, you see, and really all he charged, was, apart from the stipulated amount, would be for medicines and so on.
The horse side of your carrying business finished up in the early 70s, the early 60s. Did you miss it? Did something disappear, do you think, from city life, from the city scene?
Yes, I thought it did. We used to take a pride in our horses. They were one of the sights of Dublin. And even these days, the various old people that I meet say to me, "Oh, we remember your horses well. We love to see them going through the city," and so on and so on. People don't love to see motor lorries going through the city. Belgium.
Yup, yup. Scud the whip, mister, scud the whip. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.